And this is FM 90.1 KZFR. Welcome to Ecotopia.
You're listening to KZFR FM 90.1 Chico Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia. We'll be replaying tonight one of our favorite interviews. This is with Dan Chapman. He wrote a book called A Road Running Southward, retracing the steps of a walk by John Muir in 1897. And to set the tune, we'll hear a little Louis Armstrong. It's Sleepy Time Down South. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Schutte. Today, we're pleased to be talking with Dan Chapman. He's the author of a fascinating book titled A Road Running Southward. It tells of his observations revisiting sites that John Muir visited in a 1,000-mile walk from Louisville, Kentucky to Cedar Key, Florida. This was shortly after the Civil War.
I'm Susan Chutte, and we're happy to have Dan here. He lives in Decatur, Georgia, and has been a journalist covering topics around the world, writing for, among others, the Congressional Quarterly, the Charlotte Observer, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's the son of a newspaper man and an English teacher, which, as former English teachers, we especially appreciate. Welcome, Dan Chapman.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Okay. We just touched on your biography, Dan. Tell us a little bit more about that
background, your work, and your current focus. What are you writing, among other things?
Well, you guys gave a pretty good rundown of my previous careers. Now I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I'm fortunate enough in that I was hired to basically just write news features, kind of like AP, down the middle news feature type stuff. And so I run around the South visiting wildlife refuges and all sorts of funky ecosystems and writing about endangered species, habitats, you name it. Right now I'm writing a lot about the Okefenokee Swamp because that's kind of an important thing going on down here.
I would love that job. That sounds so cool. Is it cool?
It's not bad. What I try to do is, it's not bad. What I try to do is I write these stories, and then, of course, they appear on all sorts of federal websites, you know, Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife. But also my trick is to, like, get them placed in newspapers and magazines and nonprofit blogs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And being an ex-newsman, I know a lot of these publications are kind of hurting for copy and for for free stuff. So I give it to them.
Nice.
Need to put the Chico Enterprise Record on your email list, because we'd love to have your columns up here in the north.
All right, I'll do that.
Okay, cool. So how did you come to write a book about John Muir's travels in the South?
I obviously was somewhat familiar with John Muir, just my readings and my love for the outdoors and the environment. He was, up until just 5 years ago to me, though, your guy, a Californian.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
He wasn't really, I didn't think, you know, he knew nothing of the South. But then lo and behold, I came across the short book he wrote about his trek through the South in 1867. And I was mesmerized. I immediately bought the book. He has a nice map in the front of places he visited. And many of the places he visited, I had visited as a reporter and written stories about it. So it was sort of a serendipitous meeting of the minds, in that I'm like, I had wanted for years as a reporter, the last 10 or 15 years in particular, when I was writing more and more environmental stuff, a way to sort of stitch it all together into a hopefully seamless, you know, this is what's going in the South. These are the problems. These are some of the solutions. And this is what perhaps could be done about it. So John just basically laid out a roadmap for me, and I followed that. And along the way, you know, wrote about various environmental issues, ills primarily. And that was, you know, he made it easy for me.
Nice.
You caught our interest really early with a chapter called Ghosts, Skeeters, and Rye. And you talk about an evening spent camping in a cemetery that was visited by Muir. I wonder if you would read to us a little bit. I think our listeners would enjoy getting a feel for the tone of the book, your voice.
Sure. Let me read a couple of graphs, but first let me set the table here. As y'all pointed out earlier, Muir hiked 1,000 miles. It was actually a lot less. It was more like 900 miles, but who's going to quibble? starting in Louisville. Prior to that, he had been an itinerant sort of factory worker, very much prized by factories, manufacturers at the time, because he was very good as a tinkerer, as an inventor, and as somebody who could make factories run more efficiently. So prior to starting his trek, he was in Indianapolis working at a buggy factory, making things work more smoothly there. And prior to that, he was at a broom factory in Canada, where he was a draft dodger. and his time in Indianapolis, he had returned to the States. It was after the Civil War. He was working in this factory, made great increases in productivity, as it were, at this factory, until one day he was working on a lathe, and an implement that he was using shot off the lathe and into his right eye and immediately blinded him in his right eye. He then went home despondent to his boarding house, and his left eye sympathetically went blind also. He thought, that's it. I'm done. My whole life's calling of being a great explorer in the mold of a von Humboldt and others from Europe is now over because I won't be able to go to the Amazon or the Andes, what have you. Boo-hoo. Mm-hmm. Eventually, of course, recovered, decided if I'm going to do what I want to do, I need to get going now. He was in his late 20s. He quit the job and took a train to right across the Ohio River from Louisville, and the next day walked down into Louisville and began his 1,000-mile trek to the Gulf, where he hoped to get on a boat to make mm-hmm. it to the Andes and then the Amazon. So that's the scene overall. Tell me if I'm boring you so far, otherwise I'll continue.
Not at all. No, this okay. is fascinating. I love
so
it.
So you started out, and it was 1867, right after a couple of years after the Civil War. As you can imagine, the South was beaten up, very poor, very hungry. And it was an oddity that this chap would be walking through the South, collecting plants, putting them in a printing press, a plant press on his back, carrying them, and eventually sending them home to his brother in Wisconsin to keep for him. So he was an oddball, and he had many interesting meetings along the way. By the time he finally got to Savannah, a couple of months into his trek, he was exhausted. He was broke. The heat was coming to him. The Savannah, once you get down below Augusta along the river there and route to the town of Savannah, it changes. It becomes a little more subtropical. It's hotter. There are different trees. There are different animals, alligators, things like that. And so he was starting to get a little freaked out, I think. He was initially, you know, oh, the mountains of North Carolina and Kentucky, and they're all like, you know, what I'm used to in the foothills back in Wisconsin and Canada. But by the time he got down to Savannah, he was in bad shape. And I think he was also in the early throes of getting malaria. Mm-hmm. So he had no money. He had hoped to arrive in Savannah and go to the post and have money that his brother was supposed to wire him, awaiting him. But the money was not there. So he spent about 5 or 6 nights in Savannah, sleeping in a cemetery called Bonaventure, and each day going into town to hopefully find the money that his brother was hopefully sending to him. So I figured for the way I would tell the story in my introduction, first chapter, I would go down to Savannah and Bonaventure Cemetery and sort of recreate, you know, for a couple of days what John went through way back when. And so I, of course, properly wrote to the cemetery director for the city of Savannah and said, well, I'm working on this book, sir. Would you mind if I came and camped out for a night or two in your cemetery so I can, you know, feel, you know, my channel, my inner John Muir? And he promptly wrote back and said, not only no, but hell no, you can't do that. We don't sleep in our cemeteries. So, you know, obviously I thanked him kindly, and about a week later I jumped in my Subaru and drove down to Bonaventure Cemetery, climbed the fence, and anyway, if you want, this is the excerpt I shall read if you're so inclined.
Yes.
Okay, here goes. I figure that a popular sports bar about a mile from the cemetery is a safe, unobtrusive spot to leave my car overnight. I shoulder my knapsack, pull my Braves cap tight, and head lowered, walked briskly to Bonaventure. I'd spent the previous week in Florida chasing Hurricane Michael, showering little and shaving less. I looked the part of the hobo, searching for a place to sleep. Hard stares from residents of the working-class Victoria Heights neighborhood confirm my shady appearance. An oak-lined blacktop runs alongside Bonaventure. It is dark beyond the city's vapor-like glow and threatening rain. The wind-tousled moss dangling from tree limbs adds to the spookiness. I follow the road to the marsh, hop the fence, and enter Muir's, quote, Eden of the Dead, unquote, as biographer James B. Hunt put it. It's quiet except for the chorus of frogs, the susurrus of distant traffic, and the whine of mosquitoes. I don't see a soul, living or dead. The prospect of a long night outside amidst the deceased amidst the deceased bestirs some dread. I'd boned up the day before, foolishly in hindsight, on Bonaventure ghost stories, the phantom hellhounds that roam the cemetery, the angelic statues that glare at passers-by, the sounds of distant laughter and shattering glass, little Gracie with her bloody tears. Intent on facing my demons, I detour to Gracie's tomb and route to Muir's campsite. As my eyes grow accustomed to the dark, the contours of the headstones and the mausoleums, the towering trees and the pebble walkways come into focus. Everything is bathed in dark gray light. Gracie, in her Sunday dress and button boots, still sits straight and motionless. Nary a drop of blood sullies her chubby cheeks. I find Muir's sleeping spot. The mosquitoes haven't mellowed. I move on, wandering the cemetery and looking for signs of life. Seeing none, I begin to relax. This, quote, weird and beautiful abode of the dead, end quote, as Muir called it, is peaceful and safe. I circle the cemetery and, tired from an hour's walk, pick out a dry spot under a grand oak and a postcard-perfect palm. I lean against George Gamunson's crypt in Section E, Lot 4, and unscrew the cap from my flask of rye whiskey. According to the cemetery's registry, Gamunson died in 1888 at age 76. I later Googled him, but found nothing. I assume he was a German immigrant, and from the looks of his well-appointed tomb, most likely a successful businessman. I take another sip of rye and channel my inner Muir, but not in a creepy seancey way. I picture him, like me, staring vacantly skyward and thinking big thoughts. But then I hear fireworks in the distance, sirens in the city, and the drone of a freighter's horn on the Savannah River. It starts to rain. So much for an epiphany. I pack up and seek a larger crypt with enough of an overhang to keep me dry. I espy an imposing mausoleum at one end of a grassy plaza with an obelisk at the other. But just then, I see a woman running. I freeze. She doesn't move either, suspended in mid-stride. My heart thumps. My eyes narrow. She's frozen. In fact, she's attached to a low marble riser. Julia Denise Backus Smith was a runner, a beauty queen, a city commissioner, and a, quote, prominent member of Savannah society, end quote, who committed suicide in 2003. A closer look reveals that her bronzed likeness has oxidized into an eerie-looking green color. I was right to be freaked out. Nonetheless, I scurry past Julia and opt for the Tiedemann family crypt. At least five Tiedemanns, four named George, are buried in Section A, Lot 122. George Washington Tiedemann was a grocer and a banker and, as mayor of Savannah in the early 1900s, managed the purchase of Bonaventure for the city. I lean back and sip the whiskey. It nears midnight. The rain stops. The breeze quickens, dispersing the bugs. A three-quarter moon peaks from the clouds and illuminates the graveyard in a pleasing, otherworldly way. I'm at peace, happy as one of the clams found in the marsh along the nearby Bull River. That's probably enough.
That's lovely.
It is.
You are a really... Your writing is really lovely.
Well, thank you.
Ecotopia listeners, we're talking with Dan Chapman.
Yes.
His book is A Road Running South. It retraces John Muir's 1,000-mile walk in...
900 miles.
900 miles. I stand corrected.
Math wasn't his strong suit, I guess.
It's a fun book, but also it really gets into powerfully into issues in the South. And in your book, you have a 10 or 11 chapters of different places that you visited. We obviously can't talk about all of those, but there were a couple that particularly appealed to us. In chapter 3, you write about visiting Mammoth Cave. I hadn't anticipated you would visit a cave when I was reading the book, but what's happening underground and how does this relate to both Muir and environmental ecological issues?
Mammoth Cave, if y'all haven't been there, it's really an amazing place. I think I need to set this up a little bit by just explaining. And one of the things, the beauty, and I think a lot of people outside of the South, even in the South, don't realize just how wonderfully biodiverse the region is. You go from the southern end of the Appalachian Mountains, which get up to about 6,000, almost 7,000 feet, which out here is pretty high. You know, they're the highest peaks east of the Rockies. So you go from that sort of alpine environment, within a very few short hours, you're in sort of a subtropical, and by the time you get down to Florida, a very tropical environment. And along the way, you just have this richness of species, of birds, and a couple of stats jump to mind that 90% of the nation's birds pass through or live here in the South.
Wow.
Two-thirds of the fish, of this nation's fish, are found here. 90% of mussels, and I love mussels, so, you know, they're these funky, bivalves that really tell us a lot about nature and the world. 90% of all the nation's mussels are found in the South.
Wow.
Salamanders, we have more salamanders than anywhere in the world, including the hellbender, which you don't know. If you don't know what that is, look it up, because he's a slimy favorite of mine. And then just one other example, there's a river, it's called the Conasauga in North Georgia and a bit of Tennessee. It's 100 miles long, and it has 76 different fish species, more than both the Colorado and the Columbia rivers combined. So I wanted just to give you a sense, and that's, you know, in my day job too, what I try to do is just to, you know, let people know just about the wonderful biodiversity around us. And, you know, few places are as funkily biodiverse as Mammoth Cave, both inside and below ground. I had the great fortune to spend the day with a bunch of the Park Service biologists. You know, they do a lot of research up there too. And the first stop we took was we went way, way down into the bowels of the cave, well far beyond where the, you know, tourists can go and everything, across the River Styx, as they call it, and to look for Kentucky cave shrimp, which are translucent, little baby shrimp, translucent, eyeless shrimp that live nowhere else in the world, this particular brand of shrimp. And it is totally dependent on the whims of the outside world for its inside world, below ground existence. The Green River flows through Mammoth Cave, and so it provides the sustenance and life that these shrimp need to survive. If the water's high, then that's good for the shrimp because they have more nourishment. If the water's low, they may blink out because there's drought and there's no place for these shrimp to go. They're an endangered, terribly endangered species, again, totally dependent on the quality and quantity of the water of the Green River. And so you can imagine the pollution that would come from all the mining, oil and gas, farming, trying to think what else that affects the Green River and this species. So we spent the morning down there looking for these guys. We didn't see them, but nonetheless, it was interesting. And then we went above ground, and they were doing some work moving mussels because they were fixing a bridge. And so they moved all of these mussels from one spot and then put them further up the river. And that was fun, including meeting a 5-year-old malacologist who's paid in Oreo cookies. And then in the afternoon, we went to another off-limits section where some research was going on to study the amazing world of cave crickets and other cave insects. And like the mussels, they're kind of like canaries in the coal mine. If bad things are happening to the mussels, if bad things are happening to these crickets, then we got a problem. Mm. And bad things are happening to both. And in the crickets' case in particular, you know, they, again, they're just inside this cave. They fly out in the evening when it's dark to get nourishment, then come back and live along the walls. It's really kind of gross because they have all their, leave all their guano behind. Mm. But it's very fascinating at the same time. And I guess sort of the example there that I point to is that, you know, they're kind of the barometers of climate change. Because as the outside world to which they travel every night gets either warmer or wetter or drier, it affects them, kills them. If they don't come back, they don't return to the cave, other larger creatures can't eat them. And so the whole impact on the cycle of life, larger creatures eating the smaller creatures, gets impacted also. So I use that chapter largely to talk about you know, how these various animals are responding to these various man-made calamities.
Are there preservation efforts underway in the caves?
There are. The Park Service and then a bunch of nonprofits are doing really good work studying these. Like the example of the moving of the mussels from this one section. By law, they have to. If you're going to do anything on that impacts endangered or threatened species, mm-hmm. you have to make amends. You have to
mitigate,
either move them or propagate yeah. them or whatnot. So they were not only moving the endangered species that they came across, the mussels, but they decided to move every mussel species they came across further upriver. And I think by the time it got to them, they had moved already about 2,500 mussels further upriver.
And I have a question about that. Do they, does it affect, does it work? That's what I want to know. When they move species from where they've been to a new place, is that successful?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think on the whole, and again, I'm just talking about mussels in particular, yes, if, yes, but you can move them. Mussels mainly stay pretty sedentary. They don't move a lot over their long lives. They mm-hmm. have little feet that they dig into the ground and basically sit there moving mm-hmm. occasionally. And they let the water flow down upon them, and that's where they get their nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always... it's always sort of a ticklish thing. If you move them, will they still be able to survive and thrive? As long as you don't move them too far, as long as you move them within the same sort of habitat, i.e. right. certain mussels like riffles in the water, certain mussels like to be on right. the side or on a bend or, you know, where there are is gravel or isn't gravel. So as long as you kind of put them in that same environment, they should do okay.
Okay.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Dan Chapman. He's the author of A Road Running Southward, Following John Muir's Journey Through an Endangered Land. It's published, by the way, by Island Press. Again, you didn't exactly duplicate his walk, but we wanted to hear a little bit about Kingston, Tennessee, where there's a Muir Fest, but more discouraging, it's the site of a coal ash disaster. It's, yeah. you call it the South's checkered legacy of cheap energy. Tell us about Kingston and the Muir Fest, please.
Sure. I was, you know, I plotted on the map all John's route, and then I plotted places I wanted to go visit. I initially was going to walk the whole thing, you know, do it just like Muir did.
Mm-hmm.
But then I quickly disabused myself of that notion as I realized that a lot of the old, you know, farm-to-market trails or deer trails or whatever are now interstates and highways. And I did not relish the idea of spending, you know, 6-8 months behind a tractor trailer. So I decided instead what I would do is just, you know, pick and choose my spots. I'd head out from Atlanta in my Subaru and, you know, visit this spot or that spot, spend a couple of days there, try and camp out and really try and walk as much as I could of the more natural spots. So I was very much looking forward to going to Kingston, Tennessee, which is a really lovely spot along the river, the Tennessee River, where the Emory River and perhaps the Henry or another river all sort of come together. And I had, of course, heard, obviously, about this horrific coal ash spill back in, I guess it was 2008, but at the time when I was reporting this, it was during COVID, you know, I didn't, you know, it slipped my mind. Anyway, I got there, it was a Muir Day, it was going to be the town's celebration of John Muir and all that. They were going to release, I think Fish and Wildlife in the state were going to release a couple thousand sturgeon babies and everything. It's going to be fun.
Wow. Yeah.
So I get there and I'm looking around. It's up on this where they had the festivals up on a hill at the confluence of the river. It's just a lovely scene, you know. And I'm talking to folks. And then I talk to this one guy who's trying to build a trail through the Cumberland Plateau. And he goes, well, you see that smokestack over there, don't you? And I go, yeah, that kind of mars the view. And he goes, well, you know what that's about, don't you? And I'm like, no. And he goes, that's the scene of the Kingston coal ash spill of 2008. And all of a sudden, all my good feelings, all my good vibes kind of crashed right there. But it obviously gave me a peg, a dateline for a very important story, which was coal ash and what do we do with the remnants of burning coal for electricity. And not to delve too deeply into the history of it, but it was about the day before Christmas in 2008, big storm, and the waters breached the coal ash pond, which was like a 57-foot high wall of mud and some concrete, I guess, and other materials. It just breached that, and millions, I can't remember the exact, but millions of gallons of this toxic sludge, went barreling down, wiped out about four houses, killed a few deer, wow, one dog. But the real damage beyond that was it went into and for about a mile downstream just killed everything. I mean, we're talking about in the river about a 2 or 3 or 4 foot layer of this toxic sludge. So you can imagine just how everything there died. So I figured a good way to tell this story was to talk with the people whose job was to clean it up. And both the TVA hired, the Tennessee Valley Authority hired a contractor who came in and hired hundreds of people to clean both on the ground and in the river this toxic sludge. Well, as it later turned out, everybody but the workers knew that this stuff was nasty and could cause serious health issues. So I spent the day, this was probably about 3 or 4 years ago now, with a fellow named Tommy Johnson, who spent thousands of hours over a couple of years cleaning up this stuff, sometimes standing in it, waist high and everything. And, by the time I got to Tommy, he was so sick he couldn't work anymore.
Turns out
he was dying from many different types of cancer. He suffered also diabetes, asthma, COPD, neuropathy, blisters all over. He was just in bad shape, and gave me a very poignant, sort of description of his life and his work. And, one of the things that came out, and, there are many lawsuits that finally were filed about this, but one of the more damning and intriguing comments from the contractor in telling these folks who were working that they wouldn't give them safety equipment. And they also said, oh, this stuff is safe. You could eat it, the coal.
Oh, my God.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So anyways, dozens have since died now. And Tommy Johnson, unfortunately, died last year, too, from what many believe was indeed his, the illnesses that he accrued from cleaning this stuff up.
Wow.
Okay, again, talking with Dan Chapman. He's the author of Running Southward, Following John Muir's Journey. We're kind of looking at some of the sites he visited that particularly caught our attention. You have several chapters.
I know we don't have very much time.
Okay, Susan.
So is it clean now, number one? And number two, were they sued or did they have to pay for... in some way for how many people they made sick and perhaps died?
I haven't seen any studies done. There probably have been some studies done on have the flora and fauna returned to the river and the region there since the spill. They built a lovely park there, bought out a lot of houses. The river, I can't imagine the river is anywhere near back to what it was, because you put that much toxic chemicals on a riverbed, it's going to pretty much scour everything off. I mean, rivers, of course, they're resilient. There is, the fish have come back. Whether any of the endangered fish have come back, I don't know.
Okay.
As for the workers, there are many, many class, there's at least one large class action lawsuit filed against the contractor and the TVA. It's been wending its way through courts. They gained The workers 2 years ago gained the right to continue the suit, which was considered a victory. But as of yet, there hasn't been any large-scale payouts. And, you know, the company's prerogative is really to try to hold out as long as they can before they have to pay.
Mm-hmm. We know about that.
They have offered settlements, and some, I think, have taken it, but the settlements are, you know, really sort of paltry when you consider a man or a woman's life. So it's not completely over yet. It's still being fought out in the courts.
Okay, yeah. The other thing that we're, many things that we're interested in, but your description of the water wars remind us of what we have going on here in California and in the West, really. So what's happening to the southeastern aquifers? What are the fights? How do propertyers enter in? Because we have that going on here, too. And what are the demands on the Chattahoochee and Savannah rivers? That's a lot about water, but we want to know about water.
Water is, you know, the oft abused cliche from Mark Twain is that water's for drinking, whiskey's for fighting over, right?
Whiskey's the other way around.
Right.
Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting.
Yeah.
Thank you. See, I use it myself. I can't even get it straight. But it's also, I don't know if he really ever actually said that or not. But anyway, I digress.
But it's true.
I think Twain said a lot of stuff I've said I never said.
Well, but I think I included it in my book, so it's got to be true.
Yeah, it's
right?
Got to be
there
true.
There you go.
Sure.
It's weird here because we have a lot of rain, you know, compared to what y'all have out there.
Yeah.
There are certain western facing mountains in the Appalachians that get 90 inches of rain a year.
Yeah. Wow.
Atlanta averages like 57, 60 inches of rain a year, which is a goodly amount. You know, we're
that
very green here. For the most part, a healthy aquifer or two or three. The issue, though, and you guys are living this, is when we are in a drought. Then all bets are off.
That's right.
And we had a couple of horrific droughts in 2008 and 9 and then 2011 and 12 across the South, which, you know, really got people at the time, you know, up in arms and say, hey, we got to do something about this. The big issue for years, for 30 years now, has been the so-called water wars between Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. It revolves primarily around the Chattahoochee River, which starts in the mountains, flows through Atlanta, and then goes on down to Florida. Along the way, it meets the Flint River, and then those two rivers turn into the Apalachicola River, which flows from the Florida line on down to the Gulf of Mexico. When I say they've been fighting over this for 30 years, Florida repeatedly sued, as did Alabama, Georgia, Atlanta in particular, for using too much water. Mm-hmm. Georgia and the Corps of Engineers and others countered that, no, we need it. We're a growing city. You can't cut off a city. We understand you have endangered species down there and you have nuclear power plants too. Long and the short of it is, after 30 years, finally the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, Georgia does have a right to use pretty much as much water as they want, which ultimately is to the detriment of farmers down South Georgia and Florida. Oystermen who made they're living in the Gulf, endangered species along the Apalachicola, and other industries and farms down in the southern stretches of these rivers. So it's quiet now because we're not in a drought, but I fully expect, if not this year, then next, we'll be back in, because climate change tells us these things happen with greater frequency now. And things are going to get ugly again, and we're going to be yet again fighting amongst ourselves over water. You had more questions there, but you tell me which one.
Those were the big ones.
Yeah, I think you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, a frequent guest on our show has been the director of an organization called Aqua Alliance, and we're working hard in the north to prevent the evacuation of the northern waters to the ever thirsty south, mostly mm-hmm. agriculture. And a lot of it, farmers strategically plant crops that demand more water or are perennial. There's been a flurry of planting of pistachio trees down in the south. The pistachios take a lot of water. They're perennials, and then the pistachios are mostly shipped abroad.
So, and almonds, right?
And almonds, although almonds are not bringing in as much money as they used to. So people are.
I don't know why they allow alfalfa growing in this country, frankly.
Yes, I agree. Right. We used to watch, we lived in Nevada for a while, and I would see bales of alfalfa traveling over the Sierra. And we just say, there goes Nevada's water shipping it over. And must have been California cattle, but yes.
Or Saudi Arabian cattle or Chinese cattle.
Yeah.
Using all this water to grow a crop that we don't even use to be exported overseas just seems ridiculous.
Yeah. And that's true.
And we have the same, we have similar here. It's cotton. I spent, when I was at my last newspaper, I spent a whole year doing a major project on cotton and cotton subsidies. And I spent a lot of time in Southwest Georgia. I also went to Brazil. I also went to West Africa to follow the route of cotton and who grows it and why. And there's no reason we should really be growing cotton in this country either, but I digress.
Yeah. Listeners, we're not going to have a chance to cover all of this. We strongly recommend the book, A Road Running Southward, published by Island Press. You can read a lot more about, particularly about the water wars. I did want to ask a little bit, maybe you could give us a description of the Chattahoochee. You talked about it comes from the mountains, winds up in the Gulf. Is there anything left flowing into the Gulf after everybody is through using the Chattahoochee?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that was really the crux of, you know, the many lawsuits that Florida's governor filed against Georgia and Atlanta in particular. But, you know, it's quite bountiful up here. But even during drought, you know, we've got a couple of reservoirs above town, above Atlanta here, and they were way, way, way down during drought. So by the time the Corps of Engineers, which runs the river pretty much, the dams along the river, the reservoirs, by the time it gets down to the Gulf, there was very little left. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to the Gulf, but again, it's one of the just incredibly biodiverse regions. Not only is it, you know, a breadbasket for oysters, fish, mussels, sturgeon, you name it. But it's also, the further upriver you get, it's just critical for everything from bees to birds to all sorts of creatures. So, yes, to answer your question, there was barely a trickle when it would get down to the Gulf. And that was largely, a lot of the lawsuits were like, oh, the poor oystermen here are dying, their industry's dying because you big bad Atlanta developers are sucking up all the water.
We got that going here too. And so that leads me to a question about development. In general, we have some of the same kinds of issues about how development is impinging on land that should be, in my opinion, preserved, open space and ecosystem. So what's the story with development in the South?
The more current and sort of interesting example would be the Savannah River itself. The Savannah River, again, starts in the Appalachians and forms the border between Georgia and South Carolina before eventually getting out into, passing through the city of Savannah and going out into the Atlantic Ocean. The level of development, I mean, it's always been booming the last 20 years because people have discovered Savannah. It's a charming town. It's kind of like a mini Charleston. I prefer it because it's not as overgrown as Charleston, but it's starting to lose its sort of quaintness, and it's becoming quite a big city. And, you know, tourism's big. There's a military base there. There's the port of Savannah, which after LA and Long Beach is the largest port in the country. People don't really realize that.
I did not know.
Yeah, its port is 30 nautical miles to open ocean. So along that river there, they must continually dredge it. As they continually dredge it, as an aside, that's very harmful to all manner of flora and fauna.
Yeah.
And it also allows more salt water to push further upstream, further killing and or changing the salt marsh, the wetlands, the from fresh to saltwater wetlands, and all that entails. But what's kind of interesting now is on top of all the tourism and the charm, manufacturing due largely to the port there is booming and warehouse growth is booming. And there's a brand new under construction Hyundai electric vehicle car plant going up outside of Savannah, which obviously needs a lot of water. That is engendering other factories to join, mostly Korean factories to join alongside. But it's also leading to a building boom of residential.
Yeah.
There are serious questions now being raised as to whether the aquifer there can handle all of this. And it's gotten not necessarily ugly, but rather contentious in spots between locals who've lived there for years. Similar story, y'all know it. Locals who've lived there for years, are their wells going to go dry?
Yep.
So
exactly what's happening.
So much so that they're having to try and tap into water sources from one or two counties over. And I just read this week that a private utility, which is really sort of unheard of here, a private water utility now wants to supply water to communities around the plant, bypassing, the counties and the cities that, typically provide. So that's going to be a fascinating thing to follow in the future.
That's going to be a global phenomenon. People working hard to buy up the water and then sell it privately.
Well, an interesting aside is because on the surface, we have such an abundance and have such full aquifers that a lot of multinationals and very rich people are coming down to South Georgia and North Florida and buying up just tons and tons of farms. Bill Gates is one of them. The Chinese government is another. They bought up Bill Gates bought up the onion industry in South Georgia. And so they're coming in, and that of course leads to skyrocketing land prices and further squeezes out small farmers, all of those sorts of things. But they want the water.
Before Steve asks our usual question at the end of an interview, I just want to say I lived briefly in Atlanta, and I visited Florida and other places in the South, but I've never explored it. And for the first time in my life, I would kind of like to explore the regions that you've talked about, Tennessee, the ecosystems you've described, and the wildlife. So thank you for introducing me to a lovely new place.
Well, sure. There's just a ton of really cool, beautiful places here that, people live here kind of know them, but people who don't. And I just read this morning that we are now, the Atlanta metropolitan area is now the sixth largest in the country. So you better come quick or else it's all going to be gone.
It's going to be all one big city.
You mentioned Carl Hyacin and his comic novels about Florida. That makes me want to see Florida, particularly before it disappears.
Well, you better hurry, man, because I got this total love-hate relationship with Florida. And
Me too.
Some days I just get so angry, but again, I digress.
Well, we want to talk before we close. One of the things I noticed in the book, many of the books that we've discussed on this program have a concluding chapter where there is a long list of what everybody can do to solve the issues and problems that have been described in the book. And you hint at that every chapter describes projects that are going on, but you don't give us a list. And I'm curious about whether that's
or
I was about to say a sense of hopelessness or I know we're dwarfed by the size of the issues, that no systematic changes can remedy the situation. What do you think, Dan Chapman, about our common future and maybe what we could do about it?
Well, you know, I've gotten criticism from certain quarters that my book is depressing. And, you know, I wrote it as sort of a wake-up call, hopefully. You know, and I'm a reporter, man. I'm an ink-stained wretch. I'm not in the business of solutions, or I'm just interested in telling you what I see and what's out there. That said, and to counter my detractors who said I was overly pessimistic, I do have in there some things that are working. And yes, overall, I'm an optimist. And it's kind of hard to be these days, but I am. And a couple things come to mind. You know, John Muir, he came back here in the late 1890s. First time he'd been back here in 30-some years or whatever.
Oh, wow.
He traveled from Florida, where he convalesced after getting malaria at Cedar Key, and up to North Carolina mountains, to Roan Mountain, which, Susan, if you come, you got to check out Roan Mountain because it's just awesome. And he spent some time there, and he looked out over the successive ridges of beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. They were all filled full of trees, and it was just gorgeous. I look at that, and he just said that, you know, the beauty is still just as crazy as it was when I was here 30 years earlier. One thing he, you know, that we don't realize is that after John left, all of those mountains were completely denuded. Every tree was cut down. You've got, you know, the Smokies, you've got the Nantahala, you got the Pisgah. All of those forests were completely cut down for wood, typically northern timber barrens. So they're all in bad shape, you know, 20 years after John left. Today, you go back up to Roan Mountain, it's beautiful. All you see is what John saw, miles and miles of mountains. Well, what happened is after all of the trees were cut down, and after the timber barons realized, you know, we don't want them anymore, you know, and after all these floods started going down the Tennessee, Little Tennessee, French Broad, you name it, all the rivers up there, the federal government finally said, well, something has to be done. So the timber barons, graciously enough, sold their holdings for pennies on the acre, and the federal government bought it up, which is sort of a not little known, but it needs to be better known story of the federal government doing the right thing, buying millions of acres of land, which today is the Great Smoky Mountains National Forest, the Nantahala National Forest, the Pisgah National Forest, the Cherokee National Forest, all of these lands, which are just, you know, incredible recreational biodiverse areas. That said, and I bring that up as hopefully sort of a message of hope, in that things were bad before, but look at them now. Okay, things are getting better in certain respects and in certain places. But something you really got to keep in mind when talking about the South, and this is much different than the West. Most of the land here is privately held. Most of the you go across Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. It's all pine, commercial pine plantations. Cut them down, make toilet paper, ship the pellets to Europe, what have you. Yeah. So you really cannot do what I do, conservation, without working with private industry.
Right.
So that obviously raises issues in and of itself. That said, there's a lot of good work going on between, say, Fish and Wildlife Service, state departments of natural resources, and timber companies to, you know, work on species, to maybe not cut as much, to grow longleaf pine, all sorts of things like that. So there's hope there. There's hope in a lot of the good work that is being done with the nonprofits down here, just amazing stuff. Working with a bunch of them, trying to save, as we speak, the Okefenokee from a mine that wants to go in there. If you haven't been there, Susan, you got to stop there too.
Okay. I got a big trip now.
Yeah, I don't think y'all have anything similar to it out there. This primordial blackwater swamp, which just the level of biodiversity will blow your mind. Nice. Anyway, so there are efforts to remedy a lot of these situations. Again, the problem is problems. A lot of it is privately held and not enough money, which won't come as anybody's surprise, either federal and in particular on a state level, is available to do good, hard conservation.
Wow. This is,
She's speechless.
You've blown my mind. Yeah, such good stuff. And I like the idea of being someone who blows the whistle, you know. I mean, it's not good. And so we need people who are going to be out there doing the kind of work that you're doing. But it's also a beautiful book. You know, it's not depressing in the beauty that it presents. So thank you for that. Our guest has been Dan Chapman. He is the author of A Road Running Southward, Following John Muir's Journey Through an Endangered Land. Obviously, we love it, and it has many applications for California and elsewhere about what we need to do to save our land. It's published by Island Press, and thank you so much, Dan, for being on Ecotopia. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking both to you, and now y'all need to come visit.
Okay.
We're going to do that.
I'm already working on a plan.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. We always welcome viewer comments, viewer listeners, I guess you guys are. Check out our website, ecotopiakzfr.com, where we archive recent shows and include recordings, including this one with Dan Chapman. You can also send us ideas, suggestions, comments at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening to us tonight. And remember, you are the new day.
You are the new day. You are the new day. I will love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are the new sun in time for dawn. Let the birds all hail the morning. Love of life will urge me say, you are the new day. When I lay me down at night, knowing we must pay this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans know could slow worlds and end it all lie around me where they fall before the new day. Be. Love of life means hope for me, born on a new day. You are the new day.
This is KZFR FM 90.1 Chico, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, it's Sprouts Radio, a great show that tours the country looking for interesting stories. And then at